Right, the next matter on our calendar for oral argument, I apologize, we've had some technical issues here, is Stephen Craig Reddick versus John Leslie Cooper. Counsel, you may take your places, and while you are getting ready to begin your arguments, I'll just review some of our court procedures. You will each have 15 minutes to present your argument. Counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal as well. The podium in the center, you can raise or lower. There is a button under the middle at the front end that you can use to adjust it to your comfort. It's important when you begin your oral argument that you state your name and identify the party you represent, because we are making an audio recording of this oral argument, and that is the only recording that is allowed under our rules. So with that, when you are both ready, counsel for appellant, you may then proceed.
Good morning, Madam Chief Judge Bjorkman, Judge Wheelock, and Judge Johnson. May it please the court. My name is Christian Vu, and I represent the appellant, Mr. John Cooper. May I request 5 minutes for rebuttal?
Yes.
Thank you.
You will have that.
Your Honors, this is a case that strikes at the heart of American jurisprudence, due process rights. It's called due process, not don't process. The appellant respectfully requests that this court reverse the district court's ruling that service by publication under Minnesota Rule of Civil Procedure 404A is met when an affidavit submitted by respondent's attorney fails to strictly comply with the statute's requirements. Rather, this court should find that the plain and unambiguous language of Rule 404A mandates that service by publication must strictly comply with the statute's provisions, that because respondent's affidavit was fatally defective, this case was not properly commenced, and thus the court lacks personal jurisdiction over appellant. The standard of review for whether service of process was effective and personal jurisdiction exists is a question of law that appellate courts review de novo. Turning to appellant's argument, the plain and unambiguous language of Rule 404A. If statutory language is clear and unambiguous, courts are required to interpret the statute according to its plain meaning without resorting to statutory construction. The Minnesota Supreme Court rejects interpretations that render statutory language purposeless. A civil action is commenced as the court held in Door, and the court thereby acquires jurisdiction when personal service upon a defendant is actually made as prescribed by statute or rule. Pursuant to the plain and unambiguous language of Rule 404A1, service by publication is sufficient to confer jurisdiction only when the defendant is a resident individual domiciliary having departed from the state with intent to defraud creditors or to avoid service, or remains concealed therein with the like intent.
Mr. Vu, I want to make sure I understand exactly your position with respect to the deficiencies as to service here. I think the one is that there is no indication in the affidavit of counsel that your client had departed the state or was concealing himself with the intent to avoid service. That's one of the deficiencies, that failure of alleging that?
Correct, Your Honor.
Are there any other deficiencies?
Your Honor, there are approximately, I believe, three deficiencies with the affidavit. As you mentioned, the one regarding the intent, as the court in Shamrock held, intent has to actually be proven and actually exist as a jurisdictional fact. It can't just be believed it can't just be a belief that is said by the respondent or the plaintiff in this case. However, going to the other issues with the affidavit, if you look at the affidavit that respondent submitted on July 10th, 2023, it is clear that this affidavit failed to adhere to any of the mandatory requirements of 404A1. Respondent's affidavit on July 10th, 2023 did not state or include, quote, the existence of one of the enumerated cases. It did not state or include an affirmation that the defendant is not a resident of the state or cannot be found in the state, nor did it state that the affiant has, quote, mailed a copy of the summons to the defendant at the defendant's place of residence or that such residence is not known to the affiant. All three mandatory requirements as prescribed in the statute are missing here.
Counsel, do you agree that we can look at the at all four of the affidavits that were submitted together to determine whether or not there are any deficiencies?
Your Honor, in regards to that question, I want to point out that the language of Rule 404A1, which describes the affidavit that is required by the plaintiff as, quote, an affidavit of the plaintiff or the plaintiff's attorney, end quote. A process server from Metro Legal is clearly not covered by the rule's language. There's no statutory law or case law that respondent has alleged that would support expanding the rule's language to include others other than the plaintiff or the plaintiff's attorney. But for argument's sake, if we were to address that issue, these affidavits would still be insufficient.
Help me understand procedurally that this July 10th affidavit, when was that filed with the court?
Your Honor, that was filed on July 26th.
And was the complaint, were the summons and complaint filed with the court on July 26th as well?
It was filed with the Finance and Commerce, I believe, starting July 12th, and then ran 3 weeks subsequent.
That was
to
that. The service, but the filing with the district court. When did the plaintiff file the summons and complaint with the district court?
They all were filed at the same time on
July 26th.
Yeah,
all right.
Correct, Your Honor. Going back to your question, Judge Wheelock, the process server's affidavit states, quote, affiant further believes that said party cannot be located within the county of Hennepin or the state of Minnesota for the purpose of effecting personal service of process. This affidavit fails to state the existence of one of the previously enumerated circumstances and fails to state that she, the process server, has mailed a copy of the summons to the defendant at the defendant's place of residence or that such residence is not known to her. For those reasons, the process server's affidavit, if we were to presume that the language includes such an affidavit, also fails. In Shamrock, Your Honors, the Supreme Court concluded that Rule 404A is subject to a strict compliance standard because it is in derogation of the common law. Thus, service of process by publication that fails to strictly comply with the rule is ineffective service. Rule 404A1's language includes the following language. The affidavit shall state, pursuant to Minnesota Statute 645-44, Subdivision 6, a statute's use of the word shall indicates that the act to be performed is mandatory. Thus, the requirements of the affidavit under Rule 404A1 are mandatory. In Shute v. Powers, the Minnesota Supreme Court was deciding a case where an affidavit for publication stated the following, quote, that both defendants are non-resident individuals or are resident individuals who have departed from the state of Minnesota and cannot be found therein, end quote. The court in Shute in that case found that the affidavit failed to cite any of the jurisdictional facts required by 404A and thus was fatally defective. Respondent's July affidavit, much like the affidavit in Shute, is fatally defective because it failed to comply with the strict requirements of Rule 404A.
To the extent that, I mean, Metro Legal, it seemed like, did everything it could to investigate your client's whereabouts and to effectuate service. And obviously there was 3 weeks of publication in a legal newspaper that is used for that purpose all the time, as you know, as a lawyer. It just feels on some level that your arguments elevate form over substance, that maybe unlike some of the other cases, they may not have used the right words in the affidavit, but the right information was presented. Why am I wrong about that?
Your Honor, the Supreme Court cases in Shute and Shamrock and also Barber have held that, again, unlike a case, for example, substitute service under 403, where there can potentially be considered service if there was actual notice to the individual. This is a different standard. It's a strict compliance standard. It has been held throughout multiple Supreme Court cases. That is a strict compliance standard. And again, it's because service by publication is a disfavored type of service. It has to strictly comply because of the due process and notice issues that could arise if one does not follow it properly. Another issue with respondent's affidavit was, as previously mentioned, that first affidavit was filed with the district court on July 26th, 2023, despite publication being started July 12th, 2023. This court has always adhered to the rule that the affidavit required by 404A, by the statute and the filing, is a jurisdictional prerequisite of the publication of a summons. The Minnesota Supreme Court has made explicitly clear that Rule 404 only authorizes publication of the summons and complaint after the affidavit has been filed. However, in this case, for example, in Shute v. Powers, the plaintiff filed an affidavit for publication on May 2nd, 1967. The plaintiff then had begun publication 4 days prior to the filing of that affidavit. The Supreme Court in Shute held that 404A1 only authorizes publication after the affidavit had been filed.
So, does
Likewise,
this provide us with an independent basis on which we could rule in your favor, separate and apart from whether or not there were, in fact, deficiencies in the four affidavits that were filed?
that is correct, Your Honor. Likewise, in Barber v. Morris, the affidavit for publication was not filed until the date of the entry of judgment. The summons, meanwhile, had been published for several weeks prior to the date of the filing of the affidavit for publication. The Supreme Court in Barber held that the act of publication is a prerequisite condition essential to constitute authorized publication. Thus, because the affidavit was not filed until after the publication had been completed, the court found that service by publication was invalid and that there was no jurisdiction. If you were to look again at respondent's first attempt at service by publication in July of 2023, it fails for that reason. It was filed on July 26, 2023. However, Finance and Commerce had begun publishing it on July 12th of 2023. Thus, pursuant to the case law, Shute and Barber, that service by publication represents a separate, independent reason why plaintiff's July 23 service by publication was also improper and ineffective service.
So, Counsel, Shamrock talks about strict compliance with Rule 4.04. There's also a case that opposing counsel cites, DeCook, which allowed amendment of the original affidavit because the court determined that the errors were merely technical. Can you differentiate DeCook for us, or can you speak to how we're to determine whether or not a filing error is merely technical or not?
Yes, Your Honor. Your Honor, the issue at the issue in the Cook was a signature defect. It relates to it related to again a signature defect in the summons that related to Rule 11, I believe, of the Rules of Civil Procedure. But in that case, again, that was it was a defect that did not materially affect the issue. Give me one moment, Your Honors. This, again, going to your point, Your Honor, is that the Supreme Court has repeatedly held that strict compliance is necessary. Dick Cook, again, was a separate issue. To the extent that an amendment is even possible, whether under 406 or 407 or even a potential relation back issue, I would argue that such amendment is not possible as well under this under the laws of Minnesota. Four oh seven is in relation to amendments or potential defects of a pleading. However, service of process is a different matter entirely. It is a process that must be followed pursuant to the statutes and laws of Minnesota. A requirement of Rule 407 amendment is that such amendment is not allowed when it would prejudice the rights of a party. The Minnesota Supreme Court has upheld this position in Tharp v. Tharp. And Tharp is controlling here, and in fact, Tharp is factually similar to this current case. In Tharp, the Supreme Court held that a district court properly denied a motion to amend a defective summons pursuant to 407 after the statute of limitations had expired. The Supreme Court reasoned that the defendant would obviously be prejudiced by such an amendment because a defense which would bar the cause of action would be destroyed. Much in Tharp, this is a case where the statute of limitations would have run and respondents' attempted 407 amendment would cause substantial prejudice to appellant. It would effectively destroy the defense of the statute of limitations being expired. In terms of a potential relation back issue, is not an issue that was brought up by the district court or argued by respondent. Regardless, relation back is unavailable if an action had not been properly commenced in the first place. As previously stated, a civil action is commenced and the court acquires jurisdiction when personal service is actually made. Here, the civil action was not properly commenced back in July of 2023. And because of that, this court lacks the jurisdiction to allow a sort of relation back action to an action that didn't exist at the time and still doesn't exist as it relates to today.
All right. Counsel, your time has expired, but you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you may proceed with your argument.
My phone here because I've got my own issues with the memory problems due to a car accident. So if I'm not making sense, just tell me. On the one hand, I was just going to skim over my brief a little bit. But if I get close to running out of time, then I'll just hit what I think are the most important issues.
And if you could start with just identifying yourself and your client.
Sorry. Yes, Attorney John Krieger. I represent the respondent, the plaintiff in the other action, Steve Reddick. Good morning, judges. This was started with an accident where the plaintiff or respondent got injured. The defendant had blew a stop sign in a car and caused an accident. When the case was put in the suit, our office did a lot of investigation to try and find this defendant, and we also hired Metro Legal to personally serve and also do the background check. And we did the background check also separately to see if we could find out anything where he did. But they, when we did file the affidavit, which is actually four affidavits, a group of four affidavits on the same day, and we filed it on the same day, July 26th of 23, the same day we filed the summons and complaint. And there was four affidavits. And I believe, you know, the one affidavit that I had says, based on the stuff provided, it's, we believe everything is answered. Clearly the affidavits say that defendant can't be found. So we can't send defendant a letter. We don't have any verification. We have any correct address. So is that statute, you can't, and that's explained to the judge of district court. If we just send it out, well, then they'll say, well, how do you know that was the last known address, I guess. But they couldn't find him We couldn't find him. We couldn't verify anything where his address is, but they attempted to serve him multiple times at the address on the police report.
Counsel, I recognize that it can be difficult to locate somebody and, actually, you know, complete personal service. And I think that's why we allow, the rules allow for service by publication. As I read Rule 4.04, it does explicitly state that the affidavit shall state, and it lists out three different requirements, right? There's the existence of one of the enumerated cases that are described in the same rule, that the affiant believes the defendant is not a resident of the state or cannot be found therein, and that the affiant has mailed a copy of the summons to the defendant at their place of residence, or that the residence is not known. And as I look at the four affidavits that were that are in the record, and I, you know, I do think we can look at all four of them together. You know, I'm wondering if you can explain where in those we can find each of those three required elements.
Oh, okay. The affidavits, and again, I've got everything here. One of them says that they tried numerous times.
They also said that they could not find the one of the Metro Legal's affidavits. They say that they...
which one it is, state that they defendant could could not be found.
So in looking at these, I do see that, you know, they have the affidavit that says unsuccessful after numerous attempts.
Yep.
Attempted, unsuccessful. That might be enough to show that the resident could not be found. What about the existence of one of the enumerated cases and the mailing of a copy of the summons?
Well, and also, I don't want anyone to forget that when we got the answer after we served, and we sent it to State Farm right away, and then we, when we filed it, they filed an answer in September. But the answer was just the generic ones that where they just list a bunch of affirmative defenses, which defense attorneys do. They don't, you know, 99% of the time, the affirmative defenses aren't valid. They just list them off, whatever they can think of. So we sent a letter to the defense attorney and asked, what are you referring to on this, this, and this defense, including insufficiency of service? And that was in October. And he never responded. We finally found the answer to that in on March or in February of the following year, about 10 days after the statute ran. So I see here when I think I lost track of what you were asking. Again, you were asking me where are these affidavits? Where are the four affidavits? And I know I mentioned each one of them in my brief.
I think the concern is that even considering all the information provided in those affidavits, there are still the affidavit still did not comply with the three requirements. Specifically, they don't indicate mailing a copy of the summons to the defendant at the defendant's last place of residence.
Okay. And that one?
Or the existence of one of the enumerated cases, I guess specifically that the defendant had absented himself with the intent to avoid service.
Okay. And the reason I mentioned the other stuff is we did file an amended affidavit, and the court accepted that. We filed it as soon as we found out what the issue was in his memorandum. He didn't have it in his notice, but in notice of a motion, but in his memorandum. As soon as we found it out, we filed an amended affidavit. And that was stating everything that statute says. But if you go back to the four affidavits that were supplied on July 27th, one of them is the affidavit of not found by Metro Legal, it's district court document index number 5, but then they sent it up here, and I don't know if they keep those same affidavits. But also in Christian's Vu's, the opposing attorney's memorandum of the law, it's attached, I think, is index number 14 and 15. The affidavit not found states, affiant further believes said party cannot be located within the county of Hennepin or in the state of Minnesota for purpose of affecting service. And of course, my affidavit says that also, something similar to it too. But again, the statute says either send the letter to the last known address or state whether or not you can't find them. And of course, we stated that we can't find them.
So Mr. Krieger, the rule requires, service by publication may be made if the defendant intends to defraud creditors, either by leaving the state or by concealing himself or herself within the state. How do we know that's true here? I've read the 4 affidavits, I don't see anything that specifically states that.
Just like the case law says, it's impossible, and that's why I put my argument. It's flat out impossible and kind of ridiculous. If I make a statement like that, then I'm guessing. If I say, the statute says that I believe that that's a intent. There's no way to know what the true intent of this party is. Now, it could, as the judge was saying in his thing, it could be it could be homeless or something. Who knows? There's no way. So the statute uses the word believe that it's one of those, and that amended one says that specifically, and that was filed on.
You made reference to case law, but what case law are you referring to in connection with intent to defraud? That,
right. Well, I mean, the statute actually says the word believe. Get back to the.
But I think you said it's impossible to know.
Well, there's no, I mean, unless I personally knew the guy, and then all I can say is a bag thing. I mean, if I say I know for sure, well, that's kind of unethical. So the statute, I state my roof, it doesn't seem quite right. It has some constitutional issues and stuff.
Well, you reference case law. Is there case law that excuses you from that requirement if it's unknown?
Just like I referred to. Yeah, there was a number of cases that did talk about the issue and saying, if you show that the person, that you did a diligent search, and that's what the affidavit is for, is to show the court that you did a diligent search for this defendant, that should be sufficient, because there's really nothing else you can do if you don't know him. And one of the cases I cited there was the East, on page 22 of my brief, Easton versus Childs, but I also cited many other cases in the brief that talk about for instance, in the Wiik, W-I-I-K case, the Supreme Court stated, and that's on page 10 of my brief, that service of the summons by publication upon a resident of the state who is present therein may be made when such person either conceals himself for the purpose of avoiding service, or when after exercise of due diligence in searching for him, neither he nor his place of his residence can be found in the state at which service can be made. Appears to be settled by the cases. And that's page 9 and 10 of my brief, that site. So the issue is whether or not we did due diligence to do everything we can to find him. Now, the judge in district court said, yes, as an attorney who's worked on thousands of these cases, I don't know what else I could have done. If there's something else, I mean, we looked him up, and we use this Westlaw piece, people search, we looked him up a number of ways on the internet, and my affidavit, the district court listed a whole bunch of things that we did. The Metro Legal listed a whole bunch of sources, how they try and find someone. And they're in one of the four affidavits originally submitted. And so that case says the affidavit to be filed was not for the benefit of the party who is missing, the defendant, in this case, the appellant. It was, this requirement is not for that person. And that's why I say there's, as other case law said, there is no prejudice. Their only prejudice is that they have to continue and actually deal with the merits of the case. There is no true prejudice in any other thing.
Well, Mr. Krieger, what about the timing of when the affidavits were filed?
Right.
Is that an independent basis upon which we could actually determine that service wasn't affected here under Rule 404? It says when the complaint and affidavit have been filed. So doesn't that require that the affidavits be filed prior to the occurrence of the first publication?
Okay, and in that, to me, I looked over all this, that seems to be the most pivotal, the most important issue. And I have three arguments to that. When we, when they filed an answer, they didn't specifically say, they just said, about 5 months before the statute ran, they just said, service by publication. We sent them a letter saying that service of process was an issue. What are you talking about? Is this just, along with a bunch of other ones, saying, is this just the generic blah, blah, blah? Is there, is this really an issue? And they never responded.
But was that their obligation to respond?
I think so. As the judge stated in his thing, he just doesn't, he doesn't like that type of gamesmanship. I mean, or that type of trickery. If we just ignored it, well, then you wonder, do they have to elaborate? No, but when the other party asked him, what are you talking about? That would have gave us 4 to 5 months to correct it, even though I don't think it's in, I think it's valid as it is, but at least it gives us an opportunity in 4 or 5 months to still try and serve it.
You could have commenced the publication process again,
right,
filing the appropriate affidavits. And...
yeah, because we still couldn't find him. To this day, we don't know where he is. And so at least, and so as the district court judge is saying, they don't believe that type of gamesmanship. And I refer to it as trickery. Not that my attorney is trying to trick me, but he only gives us the information after the statute limitations run. And we needed it before. And so I think it was intentional. And so I think that's one of the arguments I list in my brief as one of, as why it isn't fair. And also that he was supposed to file a motion by a certain date. He didn't do it. He missed that deadline. And missed a deadline for answering the complaint when it's supposed to be answered by. Missed that. But as I told the judge, I'm not making an issue trying to do a default judgment. We're just trying to get the merits of the case addressed. And
so, counsel, your time has expired. I'll let you sum up in a sentence.
Okay. But... well, the defense attorney, I think the other attorney, relies on Shute versus Powers as their main case to say, but in that case, to say that you have to file it, do it before. But in that case, they really didn't discuss it. They just, it was just a part of a sentence that mentioned that you should file it before. But so they never did any analysis, any explanation or anything. Then when you get to the Easton versus Childs case, the Supreme Court actually did some reasoning and in the said that you were supposed to file it. And here's what the Supreme Court said in that case.
Okay, I told you could have like a sentence or two. So I'm going to give you about 10 seconds to wrap up. You are over your time, counsel.
Oh, sorry. The Supreme Court said in that case there is no reason why it should be filed before publication. The statute in its present form, but to support and sustain it after it has been made, being prima facie evidence that the case was where service by publication was authorized. If this is the purpose, it is apparent that this will be subserved as well as by filing it on entry of judgment as before, as well as before publication. Meaning in that case, the attorney was doing the already was doing his default motion, and then he filed the affidavit then. And so it was out later. So the Supreme Court in that case said there was no logical reason to require that. And they said, yeah, sure, it may not.
All right, counsel, we'll take a look at the case. Okay. I am going to have to cut you off there at this point. You're over your time, but we appreciate your argument. Mr. Vu, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Your Honors, there are a couple points I would like to address. First and foremost, is this apparent argument by respondent. It seems to be he's arguing potentially equitable estoppel applies in this case. I would like to point out that no Minnesota court has ever allowed equitable estoppel to remedy insufficient service of process. That's in the Blaine v. Anoka-Hennepin Independent School District case, as well as Schneider v. Buckman, both of them being Court of Appeals cases. But to the further that point, what respondent is asking this court to do is create law wherein a defense counsel, as defense counsel, I have a duty to represent the best interest in my client. It is not my legal duty to assist the plaintiff in prosecuting his case against my client. The public policy ramifications of the sort that respondent is seeking would be far-reaching and absurd. It would essentially be forcing defense attorneys to divulge legal strategy to the detriment of their client to opposing counsel. Not only would that be directly implicating attorney-client privilege communications, an attorney work product, it would, again, also have significant conflict of interest repercussions as well. Turning to the argument about the existence of whether or not one of the enumerated reasons under 404A has to exist, that was determined in Shamrock. Again, in Shamrock, it was held that 404A requires more than just a good faith allegation that the jurisdictional facts actually exist. Rather, they have to actually exist, and they have to actually be proven via an evidentiary hearing or some sort of evidentiary finding. In this case, it isn't clear from the district court's order whether or not that occurred. In Hornberger, the same thing occurred, in that case, there was an affidavit of publication stating a belief that the appellant had the required intent. And in that case, the Court of Appeals found that the district court erred by concluding that the appellant had been effectively served by publication because of that belief versus actually existing in the moment. And that actual intent being present is a separate reason to reverse the district court. Here, I believe there are three separate reasons why this court should reverse the district court. One being that actual intent, one being the language of 404A requiring the specific enumerated reasons, the listing the enumerated reason cannot be found within the state of Minnesota, as well as and the third reason being that regarding when the publication occurred. Again, case law in Shute and Barber are both controlling here. They state that publication, and from the plain language of the statute as well, that publication can only occur after the affidavit was filed. In this case, the original affidavit was filed with the district court on July 26th, wherein the publication was done on July 12th. So in that case, that was a time deficiency as well. And if this court were to accept the amended affidavit as well, again, I want to note that in Tharp v. Tharp, the substantial prejudice, respondents said that there was no substantial prejudice, but there is substantial prejudice because of the lack of that affirmative defense of the statute of limitations being expired. But to the extent that it is an issue as well, if that affidavit is to be considered, respondent would have had to then republish essentially through Finance and Commerce or some other publication. But that wasn't done, even if you were to consider the February 28, 2024 affidavit. That wasn't done, it still hasn't been done. Therefore, regardless of whether or not you look at the original affidavit on July 26th or the one on February 28, 2024, again, that one was around 20 days after the statute of limitations had expired. Neither of them are both of them are deficient in regards to 404A. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. Thank you, Respondents, Counsel. We will take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period. Thank you.